Barbara just said to me, "I love you, Alice." And I said to her, "I love you more." And I think that that is how I felt going to Gaza, trying to get there this last time on the flotilla. That I love me very much, but I think I must love the children there more. And I wanted very much to see them and to let them know that there are people in the world who care about them. I think one of the hardest things for all of us is to feel that we're suffering and nobody cares and nobody knows and nobody sees. And this is something that we can change. And that is one of the reasons I really love Mecca. I really, really love them. I think that all these years it has been so difficult for them to be maligned, to be harassed. But they have kept going because they love themselves. You know, when you love yourself, it's easy to be an activist because you know how precious everything is, because you're precious. But you also love, you love the world more. You love the children of the world more. You love the mothers. You love the grandmothers. So, you know, how could I not be here? How could I not say yes as long as I have strength? Who are we not to move forward if we have the energy to do so? When so much has been given to us and so much has been wasted, look at this poor country of ours. It has wasted so much. It has wasted almost everything. You could start with the topsoil and go on to the air. So here we are in this room, and we know we're small, but we also know that we are occupying Wall Street. We also know that we're small and we're moving. We're moving. It may be too late to move very far, but that's okay. You know, one of the stories I wanted to tell actually was that when we were on the boat, we were trying to leave Athens, Greece, and the Israelis were making it really difficult. And in fact, they sabotaged boats. They frightened the poor Greeks so that they weren't supposed to let us even leave the dock, you know, on the coast of Athens. And so we were there in Athens for almost 2 weeks, and it was hot. It was so hot. I don't like so much heat. I'm from the South, and I had enough of it. But anyway, we finally, toward the end of this long wait and all of these horrifying stories, you know, about the Mavi Marmara, we saw a film about the murders that happened on that boat. We did nonviolence training where we faced the reality of being up against people who are brutal and who don't care. And if you're singing, they hit you. And if you try to lock arms, they break your arms. And if you go limp and you lie on the ground, they step on your face. But finally, after waiting for such a long time, all of us decided, but we didn't tell the media, in fact, which was quite funny, except for the media that went with us. For instance, some people from Democracy Now!, a program that I so respect. But anyway, finally we decided that we might not get even into international waters, but we were going to leave the shore. And we did, and we got about 10 miles beyond the Greek coast before we were turned back by people who were armed. But they were armed in ignorance. They had no idea why they were trying to harm us or why they were trying to turn us back. This is one of the delusions that we're caught in, you know, of just not knowing what we're doing to each other. So one of the wonderful things that Medea Benjamin of Code Pink did was she said to them, and actually I didn't see this because I had gone downstairs to be with the circle of meditators who would actually meet the people coming on the boat. But she said to them, you know, look at you, you're holding your guns on us. But imagine if you were not holding those guns, you could use your arms for something else. And then she said to all of the people who, all of our people, turn to the person next to you and hug them. So that is what the people with the guns and their little, you know, I've never seen the ninja people things, but they kept saying that they look like ninjas. So I guess they look like ninjas and with guns. So that's what they had to deal with as they were standing on their little boat being told to harm us, that we were in fact setting out to humiliate the Israeli soldiers by throwing sulfuric acid on them. They were confronted instead by these smiling Americans, for the most part. There were some other people from other places, embracing each other. And this was part of what it meant to leave the shore. This is part of what it means to leave behind, leave it, all the things that didn't work. And we're there. We are about to leave behind, if we can keep our courage going, all the things that did not work, and most of them did not. And this means that this is a very good time, even if we only get 10 miles into the future. We may get 10 miles and be turned back by who knows what. You know, Nostradamus says that in this period, we'll see nuclear war that will destroy the West. So we may not get far, but let us leave the shore. Let us leave. Let us say, oh, you know, they put up every possible obstacle. They sabotage our boats. You know, we have this horrible record of disaster. Rain not only on the children of Palestine, but on the people who try to bring aid and assistance to people who need us in Palestine. But we are going to go, we're going to leave the shore. Another story I wanted to say briefly has to do with a young woman whose name is Lisa, and I can't remember what Lisa's last name is. I've been trying today. But she was the person who taught us our nonviolence training, and she was excellent. She was fabulous. And she, at some point I said to her, well, Lisa, you know, actually, I want you to go and take a nap because you look like you need one. She was so devoted to getting us in shape to confront whatever we had to confront. But at some point, she realized, as we all did, that we would not be able to deliver the letters. We had this cargo of letters that we were trying to deliver. We would not be able to deliver these letters. So we went to lunch one day at a restaurant, and I saw her just furiously collecting wine bottles. And, you know, just with complete intent, she was collecting these bottles, and she just kept collecting all kinds of bottles and trying them out and everything, because her dedication was that we are going to send these letters, if we have to put them in bottles and send them, throw them over the side of the boat. And essentially, that is what she and some of the other women did. They actually, I don't think, used wine bottles, because it turned out that there was something wrong with wine bottles. I don't know what it was, but they used another kind of bottle. I don't want to say the P word, but I think it might have been plastic. But in any case, they put some of the letters into these bottles along with some sand, and they, with prayers and tears, there's a video of this. I find it really difficult to look at it. It's so incredibly moving. Because it's to see the people of the world trying so hard to bring healing to the world, trying, you know, every way. I mean, I don't think Lisa could have done more than she did on the boat, making the bottles with the letters. But you see the people trying so hard to change the world, to change the situation. And then to see how you know, how horribly they're treated, how they're lied about. I mean, I think it was Ali who it on the Electronic Intifada, which he co-founded, actually ran a photograph that the Israeli Defense Fund, no, Defense Forces, had distributed to show, you know, the wicked people that we were. And there I was, beaming out there, wickedly. you know, that we were going to humiliate the soldiers when they aborted. And meanwhile, we had been spending all of our time trying to figure out how we could not harm them, that they were, in fact, coming to harm us. But how could we not harm them? And the key to this little puzzle of non-harming and harming has to do with who you harm when you harm the so-called other. And this was a teaching that was very much in action on our boat, that there is a part of you, maybe all of you, but definitely a part of you, that must not be harmed by your own need to harm someone, even if they are harming you. It's very tricky. So tonight is a special night for me to come here, to have gone on that journey, to feel that it's a success. I'm rarely discouraged. You know, I think it's my the ancestry that I have, both Native American and African, and even the poor white part. You know, the Scots, the English, and the Irish. I mean, there's a pluckiness. There's a feeling that, you know, we have seen, you know, we've seen famine, we've seen slave raids, we've seen, you know, rape and pillage and all of that, houses burned, not just in Africa, but in Scotland, you know. I mean, the whole mixture of who we are. I come with all of that, and I bring all of that to this issue of Palestine and Israel. And Ali Abunima was one of the first people to really make it all have a kind of shape for me. That if we could hold to what we know is justice, what is right, we could actually work on this and bring it to a fruition that would make us, you know, if not proud exactly, at least we could sleep a lot better. And part of it is the idea of one country for all the people who live there. And also, very, very key to that, and Ali and I were just talking about this a moment ago, the right of return. Now, if someone is chasing you out of your house, that's a terrible thing. But how much more terrible that you're not ever supposed to come back? I mean, whose idea was that as something that is okay? I mean, it's beyond belief how all of this rottenness, criminality, venality, avarice, just old-fashioned greed and, you know, meanness. This is also mean, that you would deprive people. You would just stand there and watch them forced out of their houses. And you sometimes, if you didn't tear the house down, you move right into it. In fact, I just wrote a poem about that, about, you know, everybody in this room, one of the hopes of your life should be to hope never to want the home of somebody who has been forced out by your soldiers. Never want it. Never. You will never be happy in it, because it will never be yours. So Ali Abunima is a very beautiful and wise person, And he's someone I have to smile when I think about him because he's archetypal. And I don't know if he's ever thought about this, but in every community, there is someone like Ali. And in my community, he would have been called right away an old soul. And the old soul, I was thinking today, well, what is the best characteristic of the old soul? And I believe it is that the old soul is the best listener. The old soul, the child, in the community, wherever that is the one who listens and hears and has a wonderful memory and is always making connections and always tying the past, the deep past, to the present and to the far future. This is the old soul. And so when such a person is born into a community, usually people know it within days. I mean, this is one of the remarkable things about people like Ali, and I know he's feeling very strange to hear this, but I believe it is true, because in him, his people, and you know, not just his people, but all the people who, you know, who hunger. I mean, we hunger for justice. We want it like we want bread. You know, to us, it's not just an idea. I mean, we want peace. You know, it's not just because we want them to stop shooting each other. We see that's just incredibly stupid. But we want to be happy. We want to have joy. We want to enjoy each other. So when a person like Ali is born, there is a lot of celebration because you know they're going to take on, as he has done, so much. You know, that the path is a difficult one. It is a daily challenge. It will sometimes take everything you have and more than you have. And yet, you know, there is just the reality that sometimes such a person is given to us. And we are so grateful. Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Alice. I don't know what to say. That was a very moving and humbling introduction. And I'm so grateful to be here with you and with this wonderful community. I'm grateful to be in this space, and thank you to Pastor Jack and his team for welcoming us here today. And I'm very grateful to Mecca for inviting me. This now is the third time, and Mecca is one of the organizations that I feel at peace because I know Mecca is there and it's doing the work that it does. But I know what a struggle that is. And how much work Barbara and all of the staff and volunteers at Mecca do, and how much they deserve our support, because they are not engaged in charity work. They're engaged in true solidarity at every level. Now, I'm going to start with a little something. Just a few days ago in Chicago, we had a gathering very similar to this one, also in a beautiful space at the Columbus Park Refectory in Chicago, a beautiful old building. And as we have here tonight, we had many people who are engaged in this struggle, and not just this struggle, but so many other struggles for social justice in this country and around the world, against racism, for housing, for equality, for jobs. And the organization that gathered us that day on Sunday, last Sunday, was the American Friends Service Committee, another organization which I have a great deal of respect and affection for. And we were gathered to celebrate all the work that the people in that room were doing, and we were also there to celebrate Alice Walker, who AFSC had recognized with the Inspiration for Hope Award for the work she does. And since Alice couldn't make it, she did me the tremendous honor of asking me to accept that award on her behalf, and I have brought it with me, Alice, to give to you. And this comes with love from all the people in Chicago. Because Chicago is a city that that fights, that struggles, that is in solidarity with people in Palestine, with people in Mexico, with people all over this country, with working people. People are out in the streets in Chicago as they are in San Francisco tonight and in New York and other places, an awakening of all the people who have been left out, who have been forgotten, who have been silenced, and who are saying, first of all, people are saying, you know, well, Occupy Wall Street, what does that mean? What are the demands? Where does this go? Well, as Alice said, first you have to leave the shore. And I feel that people are starting to leave the shore. And the next thing you have to say is, we exist. When you're forgotten, when you're denied, when you're dehumanized, the first declaration you have to make is that we exist. So if people haven't necessarily formed manifestos and demands, first of all, they're saying we exist. And that's very important. We exist and we resist. And when you look at what has happened in here in Oakland, I'll say more about this to put this in context, with the art exhibit and the way Mecca has fought back. First of all, let me give some advice to anyone who wishes us ill. Don't mess with Mecca. They have a print shop. And if you don't like the pictures that the children in Gaza created, because remember that children, all of us as children, all of us, and all of those who have children know this, that before we can articulate our words with speech or in writing, we draw. And if we don't have paper and pens and paint and ink, we will draw pictures in the sand. And so the pictures made by children in Gaza are the most raw and most authentic expression of their experience. And if someone wants to silence that, well, Mecca is going to duplicate those pictures and send them all over the world. And they're going to make badass posters and t-shirts, and I'm going to tell everyone about it. So you don't mess with Mecca. Now, I just really think that Alice's metaphor of leaving the shore, of leaving behind what doesn't work, is such a perfect way to think of the moment we're in. Because when it comes to Palestine, it's time to leave behind all the things that haven't worked. And we could go back a long time, but I will just go back to a couple of years, to 2008, beginning of 2009, when the wounds of children in Gaza were still burning from white phosphorus, and President Obama took office. And yet many people had hope that this man would bring some semblance of justice or a change to American policy. And even though he remained silent throughout the bombardment of Gaza and still remains silent about it today, in fact, that's not quite true because he defended it. But nevertheless, people saw some hope in the fact that for the first time in a long time, we heard a US administration demand that Israel stop stealing land and building settlements. And had he went to Cairo and talked about how important it was to end the occupation. And yet, without going into all that happened in the past 2 years, look at where we are now. The speech that President Obama gave at the United Nations 2 weeks ago, which was a surrender on top of a surrender to the very worst, most extreme politics. It was a speech which can be summarized really by the endorsement of the Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who said that he would sign on it with both hands. We are in a situation where people say, well, you know, what could the president do? Because the political forces are so arrayed against him. And we've heard that on everything. You know, we have millions of people without jobs in this country. We have especially young people. Youth unemployment is over 25%. And among African American youth, it's over 40%, approaching 50%. And people say, well, what can he do? Well, you put up a fight. Nobody asked us to come and fight. Many of us would have been there if we were asked to put up a fight. And the same is true when it comes to Palestine. He never put up a fight. And now we have these claims from the Republicans who, it's so interesting that, you know, for so many decades, U.S. support for Israel was treated as a bipartisan issue. And you didn't see Republicans and Democrats disagreeing about support for Israel. You'd see, you know, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi standing next to each other, standing behind the Israeli Prime Minister in Congress and agreeing. I mean, I think that, you know, this could have been a really good device to get Congress to do some things. They can't agree on health care reform? Call it Israel care, and then they'll agree. You know, you can't get funding for schools? Change the name of the schools to Israel, and they'll be funded. You know, we have a situation where in the last budget negotiations, they cut, what was it, $514 million for women and infants for nutrition programs. And nobody's talking about, in this country, they're closing down firehouses and police stations and libraries and cutting pay to teachers. We're told that there's in Congress people saying the United Nations is getting too much funding from the United States. Well, maybe it is, I don't know. But nobody's talking about the billions of dollars that go to Israel. Well, Israelis have health care. They have public health care. So we have this Congress that insists on subsidizing, what is it, socialist health care for Israelis. It's a Congress of socialists, but only when it comes to Israel. So we can't have a discussion about any of these things because right now the Republicans and Democrats are engaged in a competition to see who can be more fanatically pro-Israel. So it would seem that, you know, just as the young people who are in the streets have concluded that you know, waiting till 2012, and if we can just get the House back into Democratic hands, then everything will be okay. And, you know, if people are tired of that, they're saying we have to go and occupy the streets. And we don't know where this will go, but they're leaving the shore. Well, We already understood that when it came to Palestine. And for the past few years, we have seen a growing global solidarity movement. The support for Palestinian rights has always been strong around the world. Our problem has been how to mobilize it, how to turn it into power, how to turn all that latent support into power that can actually bring change. And I think that over the past few years, we've been seeing a movement growing, particularly among Palestinians, a renewed and redoubled steadfastness among Palestinians in every part of Palestine, whether it's Bedouin in the Naqab in the south being driven off their land, another 30,000 who are now being targeted for expulsion from their land in the Naqab region of southern Palestine, whether it is people in the West Bank seeing their land constantly shrinking as settlers take it, or whether it's people in Gaza living under a brutal siege and blockade. And internationally, we've seen growing support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and it's growing all the time. You remember a few years ago when we were told BDS will never amount to anything. This will never catch on. This will never make a difference. And there's still a long way to go. But I don't think that the Jewish federations would have allocated, as they did earlier this year, $6 million to fight BDS if they didn't think it was going somewhere. I don't think that the local organizations affiliated with this national anti-Palestinian effort would have put so much effort into suppressing pictures drawn by children if they didn't think this movement was going somewhere. Did you see the headline in the foreword? Bay Area Jewish groups celebrate shutting down art exhibit. That was the headline. Who celebrates shutting down an art exhibit? Who celebrates shutting down a children's art exhibit? It shows me that there is a loss of perspective, a loss of humanity, a total absence of introspection among the groups that engage in this kind of intimidation and thuggery. But what happened in Oakland with the Museum of Children's Art is not isolated. And I think it's very important to understand the phase we are in in this struggle. And it's one where we're going to see much more thrown at us, at all of us. I mentioned the escalating efforts, the millions of dollars allocated to fighting this movement for human rights in Palestine. Back in February 2010, the Re'ut Institute, an Israeli think tank closely affiliated with the government, issued a report saying that the greatest threat to Israel was not an invading army, not Iranian nuclear weapons. By the way, just yesterday, Haaretz had a piece saying that the former head of the Mossad, Israel's foreign state-sponsored international death squad, the Mossad, said that Iran was many years away from making a nuclear weapon. They really need to coordinate their propaganda messages better with the prime minister before he goes to make speeches at the United Nations. But in any case, the Re'ut Institute said that the greatest threat to Israel was what it called delegitimization. That Israel focuses on military threats, but the greatest threat is actually political. It's a threat to the legitimacy of Israel, and that Israel faces the prospect of collapse, like apartheid South Africa or East Germany. The one thing they didn't get is that apartheid South Africa collapsed because apartheid is bad, and people resisted it because it's a bad thing. Not just because there were all these bad people who are, you know, anti-Africana or anti-white, but because there was a struggle for people's rights. But their recommendation was not what my recommendation would have been. Now, if I were making the recommendations, I would say, do justice, and then all of these things you fear will go away. The answer from the Re'ut Institute, and this was what went out to the Israeli government and the pro-Israel groups around the world, was to sabotage and attack the delegitimizers, what they called the delegitimizers, which is all of us. And we were very jealous in Chicago that the Bay Area got named as a delegitimization hub in their report. We work very hard. We work very hard too. And we also want that recognition. Now, interestingly, when we wrote about this report on the Electronic Intifada, we reported on it and we included also a PowerPoint presentation that had been given by Gidi Greenstein, the head of the Re'ut Institute, in which he said that Israel's intelligence services should engage in sabotage and attack of the Solidarity Movement. They suddenly realized that, you know, this wasn't such a great thing to publish, so they changed the report. But of course we kept copies, and if you go to the Electronic Intifada, you can see the original words calling for sabotage an attack. And I think that's what happened to you here, that this is what happened with the art exhibit. But it's not just here. We've seen also, just a couple of weeks ago, the Irvine 11, 10 students who were hauled before a criminal court in Orange County and prosecuted for protesting a representative of the Israeli government, a former spokesman of the Israeli army during Israel's 2006 bombardment of Lebanon, who had himself taken part in the 1982 invasion of Lebanon that killed tens of thousands of people. They had briefly protested. It was what they called and what the prosecutors called a Chicago-style protest. You know, you think Chicago-style hot dogs. And I'm very proud that they had been inspired by our Chicago-style reception for Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister, who came shamefully to the University of Chicago. They received him and honored him by giving him a platform to give a lecture on leadership. And they paid him tens of thousands of dollars. And they were giving him as an example to the students of leadership. Not, I mean, leave aside, you know, the university doesn't care about the lives of Lebanese and Palestinian children, but the man was on trial at the same time for corruption in Israel. And he was giving the Harris School of Public Policy annual lecture on leadership. These are the great institutions of our country. In any case, when Olmert came and they banned the media from the auditorium, they banned cameras, they banned any kind of recording equipment, well, we took it in anyway. And when we protested, we stood up one at a time and we filmed it and we put it up on the website. And then the following week he came to San Francisco and he got the same reception. I know there are some people in this room who welcomed Ehud Olmert to San Francisco. And that's what inspired the students at Irvine. And Orange County put the top homicide DA on their case. And they wanted these young people to go to prison. And they were convicted. And they were sentenced to 3 years of probation and 56 hours of community service. But they're unbowed. But that was part of the effort to suppress, to delegitimize protest. And there's always been a tradition of protest. When power won't listen, when it doesn't give you a channel to be heard, to change things, you have to stand up. You have to disrupt things. No change came, no important step forward came without somebody disrupting the existing order. And saying, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to play by the rules that you have set up to preserve your power and your privilege and your situation. In Chicago, just over a year ago, and in Minneapolis and other cities, the FBI came a-calling to many of our friends and colleagues and brothers and sisters, and they started issuing subpoenas, and they raided the homes of a number of activists involved in Palestine solidarity work and labor rights work in this country and abroad. And for more than a year, there has been this witch hunt. They never indicted anyone. They never said there was a danger to anyone. In fact, they said the opposite. There's no danger to the public. What we think they're doing, what we're sure they're doing, is a witch hunt against activists who are engaged in international solidarity work. And there's a lot about those cases on the Stop FBI website and on the Electronic Intifada as well. And the Washington Post did a big piece on this a few months ago that was quite strong. But what they didn't count on, because they subpoenaed more than two dozen people, and you know, if you defy a federal grand jury subpoena, you can go to jail. Nobody has gone to jail yet, and I hope nobody will, because I believe they did not count on the huge national community response. The number of people who came into the streets, who responded to the call-in days, and who simply expressed their opposition to this. And I think that's a victory. I think it's because of that public response that they have not dared to put anyone in jail. And I think we have to keep up the pressure. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence that the United States, and this has been included in speeches both by President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have pledged the United States to help fight delegitimization. They have adopted the terminology and adopted the word, even, that was given by the Ra'ut Institute and by the Israeli government. So what does it mean for the United States? If we know that that the delegitimizers is you here, all of us in this room, and us in Chicago, and the folks everywhere else in this country who are fighting for justice, what does it mean for the government of the United States to fight delegitimization? It means that they're going to fight us. And they have a history of that. Everybody knows what the government has been doing to people's movements in this country, from the labor rights movement in the early part of the 20th century through the civil rights movement to this present day. So we have to see these things as connected, but also to understand our strength, that our response does matter. That when they did these things, immediately in the wake of 9/11, and they came after people who were identified as scary Muslims and had beards, but what they were actually doing was raising money for schools and clinics and communities in Palestine. But they shut down those charities, and they put those people in jail, and they said they were terrorists. Nobody, very few people, dared to raise a peep, because there was so much fear and intimidation. And they thought they could keep getting away with this. And so they came after they were done with the Muslims, they came after the labor movement, and the left-wing groups and whoever else it is, and they thought the response would also be silent. But people are leaving the shore of fear, and they're starting to come back together and to say enough. And I think that really made a huge difference. You look at what's been happening at the universities and the campuses. Less than 2 weeks, will be the first national Students for Justice in Palestine conference at Columbia University. Is there anyone from here going? Yeah, I can see some hands going up. And this is incredibly important because students time and again prove to be the conscience of a society, the ones who demand that issues that no one wants to talk about be put on the agenda. And so students are bringing forward divestment initiatives on their campuses, and not just about Palestine, but the whole range of US militarism empire around the world, the role of arms companies, and the close connections between universities and the military establishment is being put in the spotlight by students. And we see also the anti-Palestinian groups moving against the college campuses. And we see a very disturbing trend taking shape that it's very, I think, important to understand. Just in the past few days, it was revealed that the United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights was launching an investigation at Columbia University, coincidence of coincidences, based on an alleged claim that a student's civil rights had been violated because she was steered away from a course given by Professor Joseph Messad. This has nothing to do with Professor Joseph Mesad, and the university issued a strong statement saying that. But what it does have to do with is that those bringing the civil rights complaint are members of a national pro-Israel group, Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. And what the key person is himself a former head of the Office of Civil Rights, who now works for a pro-Israel organization. And what we've seen is a pattern of using Title VI civil rights legislation, which was designed to turn back and protect students from the institutionalized racism that existed in the pre-civil rights period, to use that legislation to silence discussion of Israeli apartheid. In other words, to use civil rights legislation to protect racism and apartheid. And the first case, the first investigation by the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, started here in California at UC Santa Cruz in March. And the Chronicle of Higher Education reported that the investigation was opened because of speech critical of Israel on campus. The legal theory that's being used is that since criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, then criticism of Israel on campus is a violation of the civil rights of Jewish students. I mean, I think that's an anti-Semitic argument because it automatically assumes that all Jewish people identify with Israel and identify with Israel's racist ideology, and we know that that's not the case. But from UC Santa Cruz, we discovered in August, we published a story in the Electronic Intifada Stand With Us, another national pro-Israel group, was preparing a similar civil rights complaint against Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Evergreen State was the college attended by Rachel Corrie. And the students at Evergreen State had passed a resolution last year calling on Evergreen State to divest from Israel. So, to divest from particular companies, not just generally from Israel, but they had identified the companies, including Caterpillar, that made the bulldozer that the Israeli army used to murder Rachel Corrie. The students at her college wanted their college's money out of Caterpillar. What was so interesting about what we discovered from documents that were not supposed to be published, but Stand With Us had accidentally published online, they were engaged, they're preparing this civil rights complaint against Evergreen State, and they were planning a lawsuit, which they've now filed. We believe they filed it because we revealed their plan to do so, against the Olympia Food Co-op, which also took a historic decision to respond to the Palestinian call for boycott and to deshelve Israeli goods. Two things are interesting about this. First of all of these things were discussed in person between Stand With Us and a representative of the Israeli government, the Consul General in San Francisco, Akiva Tor, who actually went up to Olympia to meet with the plaintiffs who were going to file the lawsuit, who did eventually file the lawsuit against Olympia, and to discuss the civil rights complaint against Evergreen State. You might wonder how it is that the representative of a foreign government is getting involved in these issues, but we believe this is not a coincidence. I think that this is part of a pattern and a policy. And I don't have any evidence of this, but I would not be surprised if the effort to censor the children's art involved the same kind of coordination. That's something worth asking, at least. So I'm telling you all of this because this we're going to face more of this, and it is coming at us more and more. But the second important and interesting thing about all of these things is what they don't deal with. Have you noticed? The effort to suppress the Olympia Food Co-op boycott, the lawsuit, is procedural. They're not arguing about Israeli policies or whether boycott is right or wrong. They're claiming that the board did not follow the proper procedures. With the Irvine 11, they didn't want to talk about the rights and wrongs of a representative. I mean, they're talking about the free speech rights of Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador. He wasn't there to give his personal opinion. He was there to represent a state and a government engaged in crimes. It's not as if the Israeli government doesn't have enough opportunities to make its views heard in the United States. They didn't want to talk about that. So they prosecuted the students under an obscure law about disrupting public meetings. The civil rights complaints, the same pattern. They tried to change the focus away from what the students and faculty who are being targeted want to talk about, which is what's happening in Palestine and the US role, to saying that your actions are making students on this campus feel uncomfortable. And all of this is about changing the subject. And what it tells us is that they understand something very important, that they have lost the argument. And we are winning the argument, because the arguments for Palestinian rights are the arguments for the rights and dignity of all human beings. They're arguments that say that in the 21st century, you cannot have a situation where a grandmother born in Palestine is not allowed to return to her home, to her village, just because she's not a Jew. Whereas somebody from San Francisco or Canada or Argentina who's never set foot in Palestine is allowed to go and settle there and take people's land and receive all kinds of state funding simply because of some arbitrary designation. Would we accept that if it was about skin color? Would we say, oh, well, you know, this is very reasonable. We have to understand their fears. So in the 21st century, these arguments don't stand and they can't be won. Although, by the way, in this country, there's plenty of people who would like to turn back the clock. And so that's very important to understand, is that we are winning the argument, and we are facing increasingly these kinds of bullying and intimidation measures that I think, if we're aware of them, if we're smart, if we're united, we'll defeat. They won't stop us. It's not as if they're going to stop us or intimidate us or prevent us from continuing to fight for what we believe in. And they look. You look at some of the other efforts to change the subject, which I think have failed totally. The public relations strategies about greenwashing and pinkwashing, or gaywashing as it's sometimes called, that say, well, oh, you know, Israel's a wonderful place. Look how many trees they plant. Don't look at how many trees they uproot. And, you know, you should support Israel because, you know, they have a gay pride parade in Tel Aviv, and they don't have a gay pride parade in Gaza. I don't think these arguments will work because, and then, you know, Israel has all this wonderful medical science. Well, let's suppose that tomorrow Israeli scientists, funded by the Israeli government, develop a cure for cancer. And that would be a wonderful thing. And there's no doubt that humanity would benefit. But what would be the answer to that? To say, okay, well, since you cured cancer, you can carry on treating Palestinians like, you know, they're not humans. You can carry on taking their land. Why don't you build that apartheid wall a little higher? I don't think that's what the reaction would be. It would be, how can a community that has produced this marvel carry on in this atrocious way? And you must hasten to end it even faster. So that doesn't buy them anything. I don't think the pinkwashing arguments work because they depend on silencing queer people and ventriloquizing them. And what we've heard instead is tremendous resistance saying, no, the state of Israel doesn't speak for us and it doesn't define the boundaries of our solidarity. So looking looking forward, in his speech to AIPAC in May, President Obama said the following. And it's so interesting because there's a kind of bluntness to this. Here are the facts we must all confront. First, the number of Palestinians living west of the Jordan River is growing rapidly and fundamentally, reshaping the demographic realities of both Israel and the Palestinian territories. This will make it harder and harder without a peace deal to maintain Israel as both a Jewish state and a democratic state. That was the president. Now, of course, he's right about the fact that time is running out, not for Israel as a Jewish state or a democratic state, because I would argue that it's neither. It is a sectarian state, an apartheid state. It's never been a democracy, because the democracy was always predicated on the removal, first of all, and the exclusion of those who are not to be included in citizenship. It's like saying the United States has been a democracy for, you know, what did they teach kids in grade school? The United States has been a democracy for 200 years. Oh, really? So it was a democracy when people had slaves. It was a democracy when black people couldn't vote. It was a democracy when women couldn't vote. It was a democracy when only property owners could vote. Well, by that standard, Saudi Arabia is already a democracy. I mean, at best, the United States has been a democracy since 1965, and it's a fledgling democracy which is not getting very high off the ground and has a lot to learn and seems to be going backwards in many respects. But so, yeah, if you apply those standards, Israel is a democracy. But despite all of that, Obama is pointing out a simple reality that Palestinians, if they are not already, will soon be the majority population in historic Palestine, as they were prior to 1948. Of course, he does not call for the morally correct solution, decolonization of the relationship between these populations, equal rights for all who live within the territory, and all who have been unjustly excluded. and restitution and recompense for those who have suffered and lost during this period. Instead, the president exhorts Israel to rush to create a little Palestinian statelet, and the false belief that a Palestinian state on a fraction of historic Palestine can fulfill the rights of 11 million Palestinians, or at least sabotage their claim to any greater rights. His use of demographic scaremongering, which you sometimes hear in the United States, of course, about the threat to the United States from the rapidly growing Latino population, the threat, in the words of those who view it that way. But his use of that kind of demographic scaremongering indicates an acceptance of what I see as a fundamentally racist view that the mere existence of certain categories of humans, in the case of Israel, non-Jewish Palestinians, is unacceptable and dangerous, and they have to be limited and contained in a state which is tightly circumscribed. The alternative, as we move away from the shore and leave behind everything that hasn't worked, I think is what is set out clearly in the 2005 Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And some of you know this well, and some of you will be hearing it for the first time. In 2005, almost 200 Palestinian civil society organizations, this is endorsed across Palestinian civil society, inside and outside, called for Israel to be isolated the way apartheid South Africa was, and until Israel respects the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and upholds international law in three specific ways. All of them have to be met, because human rights are not divisible. We can't have only some of our rights. As humans, we deserve all our rights. First, ending the occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the West Bank Wall. Second, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And third, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. And these three conditions together are really the very measure of equality and valuing Palestinians the same as anyone else is valued. I think if we meet again in a couple of years' time, there will have been more attempts to turn us back towards the shore we left, but I have no doubt that we are very much going to keep trying to leave every time, and we are eventually, and in the not too distant future, going to reach the other side. Thank you.